Elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, it makes the simple statement that out of 1,000 people, only one of them seeks God. And out of 1,000 who seek God, only one of them finds God. Yogananda said that on this path our percentage is higher. But nonetheless, it's a very, very refined and small number of people who become seriously and genuinely interested in spiritual liberation. And there is actually very good reasons for it. It's very difficult. It's a very long commitment. It runs counter to what the world around you is saying. It runs counter to even what vast parts of our own selves are saying. And if even out of 1,000 people in the world, only one is even interested in self-realization, and then you have 1,000 people who are interested and only one of them actually makes it to the end, one has to ask the question, why do so many fail, and what is the secret? Now, of course, when he says only one actually attains God realization, it may be in the moment, because eventually everybody will get it straight. But we're not really interested in the statistics of it. Swami Kriyananda remarked that there is no such thing as statistics. He said there's only individual karma. It doesn't matter what the odds are against it happening or for it happening. What will come to you is your karma and nothing else. You won't get what you think you're supposed to get because you're the eighth person in line and every eighth person gets it. It just doesn't happen that way. But what we're always all working with is we're just working with this incredibly complicated, self-contradictory, endlessly annoying mess, which is the accumulated habit, attitude, self-identification, self-definition that we have spent such a long time building up. If one thinks about individual evolution, when you think of going through the animal stage and then gradually getting to the human stage and then going through all the different levels of humanity that you see, and we live in this particular area, in this country, in this part of this country. We live in an extraordinarily refined atmosphere where there's so much energy and alertness and awake, enthusiastic, that we're already living among people who have gone a great distance in the evolutionary cycle. By no means are people saintly or free, but they're pretty wide awake, they're pretty energetic, creative, they're operating a tremendous number of divine laws, which is really why it's a lot of fun to live here, because everywhere you turn, people are doing something interesting and energetic. You go to other parts of the world, you go to other parts of the country, and you see masses of people equally divine, equally belonging to God, equally loved by God, but they're working on a different stage of understanding. In the Indian system, when they talk about the caste, which has now become an instrument of social corruption, but the actual principle of the caste is actually just stages of evolution of spiritual consciousness from being completely physical, motivated only by the threat of punishment, and the idea of happiness being the less energy I can put out, the better I'll feel, to the point where I'm willing to use my energy as long as I get something back. You know, look, if I work a little harder, I get a little more money. If I get a little more money, I can have a little more control over you. And that's actually progress. Greed and selfishness is progress from being too dull even to work. So there was a movie that came out. I don't even remember what it was. The first caste is called Shudra. The second caste, where we're willing to work hard if we get something, is called Vaishya. And Jyotish described this movie as the touching story of a Shudra becoming a Vaishya, you know, which in fact it was. He was waking up to his own potential, and then he got energetic enough to be selfish, you know. So God actually cheers when you progress that far. But then we're energetically selfish, which is really what our country is based on right now, and most of the people in charge are very energetically selfish. It's not like you don't have intelligence. It's not like you don't have willpower, even the capacity to manifest. But it's all, what can I get? And I'll give only according to what I can get. And we all work through that for a long time. If you think about relationships, work, everything fits into one of these categories. But bear in mind that our inner life is a mess, so we're not in even categories. You know, there's still large parts of us, even when we're energetic enough to be selfish, there's still large parts of us that think it's too much trouble, and we just rather, what's the phrase? There's a new phrase now, binge watching, I've heard, you know, where you just start on season one of whatever it is, and because it can be presented to you, you can do it all the time. We have to make up new words for these things, you know, because there was never the concept even before. But then you just sit there and you get to be a vegetable. And the reason we do it is because it feels good. I mean, in our little sphere of things, it feels good, doesn't it, to be able to be like that? Some people really like to overeat, to oversleep, to overdrink, and they think all of that feels really good, to eat big, heavy meals and then just be completely slothful while we binge watch, you know. To some people, this is like a perfect weekend. And then others have enough energy to want more money, so they put in more time and energy and they make things happen. And then gradually what happens when you do that for a while for what you can get is that you begin to realize that what is really fun is putting out energy. What's really fun is making things happen. And then accidentally we begin to discover what's really fun is making things happen for other people, helping other people. But we don't learn that from being told. Somebody who's at the Shudra level who says, oh, you'll be much happier if you work selflessly for other people. It's like the whole idea. It's like, well, in the Gita, in another place, it talks about how you gradually begin to understand spiritual teaching. And there's just phases. First, you never even hear about it. And there's a phase where you hear about it, but as soon as people start talking about spiritual things, you fall asleep. It's like you have the karma to be where it's spoken, but you don't have the energy to hear it, just like that. Because there's no place for it to fit. And it's not going to help. It's not going to help to be told this world is a dream and that nothing really matters, because the Shudra is just waiting to hear that. What a justification. So we have to become energetically selfish. And then we gradually realize from experience that even though it's fun to get for myself, it's more fun to get for others. We start with the family, we'll take care of our children, we'll take care of our grandchildren, then we accidentally take care of one of our children's friends, and we discover that that wasn't so bad, then maybe we help a neighbor, and what happens is a more refined level of enjoyment begins to set in. It's all about an increasing of our inner positive experience, because that's why we do things. Nobody does anything unless there's something pleasurable in it for them. Now, pleasurable is a relative word, because being in a complete torpor and putting out no energy is not pleasurable to everyone if you've discovered a more advanced pleasure. And being selfish is very satisfying to some people until they've discovered the greater joy of integrating into a greater reality. And also understanding that at the Vaishya level, the second chakra, second caste level, we feel each one of these has characteristics, and the characteristic of the I'm willing to put on energy if I can get something for myself is that I will be happy when I can control the world around me. When I have enough money and enough power, that's what people are looking for, to be able to control the world around me. And money is the beginning of that, but what money means to most people is also power. And it may be power over, but it leads to power to buy my own land, to own my own house, to set my own work hours, to give to my children and make them loyal to me by buying their loyalty or whatever it might be. But we want control over the world around us. And we work long and hard for many, many incarnations to get that control. Because gradually from the Shudra level, we feel powerless. When we wake up enough, we feel powerless and we see how to get power. And all of that is progressive. That's the tricky part. You see, that's all progressive. Just even trying to exercise control over the world requires that I be awake and energetic and concentrated and work with great force. But what happens to us? And this is where you see there are greater realities happening behind all of this. Is the real problem with that is it doesn't work. It would be a great system if it worked, but it doesn't work. Our bodies break down. The children we give birth to turn out to be uninterested in what we think they ought to do. They end up with destinies of their own that don't match all of what we think is supposed to happen. People betray us. The volcanoes explode. You know, hurricanes come. We get hit by a car. You know, all kinds of things happen. There's this story of this man. It's not a story. It's a true story. When I was first starting out in health foods, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s, when we were beginning to eat healthy, there were hundreds of really wacky theories going around. There's actually now there's thousands of really wacky theories going around. Then there were only hundreds because we didn't have the internet. So one of them was the mucusless diet, which I think is probably still vivid, where all of life's problems are caused by an excess of mucus. I'm not even quite sure what mucus is, but it sounds icky. You know, nobody likes it. So there was this whole, this man, I can't remember his name now, but he had this whole theory in these very convincing books, you know, that described in gross detail the consequences of too much mucus, and how if you went on this particular diet, which was primarily fruit, as I recall, you go on this diet, then you go on the mucusless diet. It was a very big thing. People were doing it. And this man who was living at that time was, you know, this powerful example of the mucusless diet. And since death was caused by mucus, he wasn't going to die either. He was just as strong as he could be. And then he stepped off a curb and was hit by a truck. It's not, I mean, it wasn't that I was happy to see him die, but, you know, really. Master tells the story of meeting a health food nut in Arizona. This is a story Yogananda told, and this man comes before you. I mean, here's Master in this country. He's teaching self-realization, but it's the 1920s, the 1930s. Everybody, they were really on the edge. So this man comes up and announces to Master, "I cheated St. Peter 3 times with carrot juice," he said like that, meaning I would have died 3 times. St. Peter would have come to get me, but I cheated St. Peter 3 times with carrot juice. And Master said, "My friend, when St. Peter wants to take you, you can bathe in the stuff and it won't save you." The problem is it doesn't work. And all of us, to some degree, have noticed that. No one comes into this temple until it's crossed your mind that what I'm seeking is not outside myself, but somewhere inside of me. So the transition from the third caste, the Vaishya caste, from the second to the third caste, which is the Kshatriya caste, soldier, warrior, king is what the Kshatriya is realizing that the battle is not to control the world out there. The battle is to control my own consciousness. I mean, when you really think about that, that is such a revolutionary shift. But the difficulty is that we've spent really, literally thousands, I mean, I think it's millions of incarnations getting to the point where it occurs to us that all the skills that we've developed in this way now have to be abandoned in favor of this higher reality. And it's not so easy to just let go of what was working. I see it, and I see it in so many other people around me. Whenever we get a certain momentum in a certain direction, we think if it's not working, if we just did more of it. You know, I know they say the definition of being crazy is to do the same thing over and over expecting a different result. That's the definition of being a person. We just do the same thing over and over. And we think this time, we do it incarnation after incarnation. Master said the subtlety of reincarnation is not that life is horrible. It's that life is almost good or almost perfect. And it was just like most things worked, this incarnation, we say. Except I was a little too fat. I was a little too skinny. I was a little too male. I was a little too female. I wasn't artistic enough. I'll just tinker just a little. Just a few little things. So we come back in and we try the whole thing again. And then it almost works. If it just failed completely, we'd figure it out really fast. But we're almost happy. And we have to go through being almost happy millions of times before we really realize that something completely other is happening, before somebody talks to us about spiritual truth and we stop falling asleep. Because something in there resonates. Wait a minute, this whole story is a different story. Listening to Kripa Maya reading that, just how complicated that this particular reading is this week, how many different aspects there are to it. How can we even begin to believe it? What to speak of knowing what to do? How can we be told your happiness is not dependent on any condition of your life? You have absolute freedom. Now, the way people start translating that now, because these things sort of, they start here and then they kind of ripple down. Now that means you can have anything you want. You know, you are the master of your own destiny. You can determine your own happiness. So then that means I can get all the money I want. I can get, you know, the right relationships. I can make it work. So we take these spiritual principles and we apply them to being Vaishyas. And to a certain extent, that's progress. You know, some of the extraordinary creativity you see in this area and really inspired, innovative ideas that are just, you know, popping out in all directions, it's because people are standing somewhere on this spectrum. And oftentimes we start out with a very generous, uplifted idea. And then, I mean, you watch what's happening now with these big companies that used to be just a few people having a really good time. But they were having such a good time, it just got bigger and bigger, and now it becomes something else, and it's all the selfishness and greed, and here we are again. But now we stand as kshatriyas. And now we have to understand that it's myself I need to conquer. And when that idea, if we're bright and energetic and used to putting out energy, you just think, once I get the idea, I've got it. For some weird reason, when I first came on the path, I just decided it would take me 5 years to just kind of finish. Where that number came from, I have no idea. Master said, we carry within us a portable paradise. He was so colorful with his language, a portable paradise. That was a very early phrase, and it always stayed within me. It's kind of big. It's like a garden. It hangs out somewhere, you know, between my heart and my tummy. You know, it's just right in here somewhere. I mean, that was my picture, that I have this little portable paradise, and in about 5 years, I'm going to live there all the time. Didn't happen. I just, like, because everywhere I went in that little portable paradise, I was still there. That, you know, the all of the me's that had developed myself up to that point. And this is you get into this strange relationship with yourself. And I'm talking about the out of the one who seeks what happens to the other 999, is that it takes more than 5 years. I don't even want to even think about how long it takes. It doesn't really matter how long it takes. It's a very big project. And it can't be rushed merely because we're impatient. In the Gita, they talk about the smoke that obscures the fire is just a little puff of wind and it's gone. Then the rust that obscures the mirror, and that, of course, is the mirror is silver and it's begun to tarnish. This was a different technology. But if you have a tarnished mirror, you have to really work hard to get it off. But still, you can apply your effort and change it. You can, at the smoke, you can rub on the mirror. But then there's a whole other kind of delusion, which is called the baby in the womb. You know, I've never been pregnant myself, but I understand it gets a little tiresome at a certain point. I mean, and I see ladies who are in the last stages of their pregnancy, and uncomfortable is the only word I can think of. They look really uncomfortable. But as I understand it, no amount of determination on your part is going to get that baby out of your womb any earlier than the baby is ready to come. Or if it does come, it is not the result that you wish at all. There's absolutely nothing that you can do. There is a greater destiny and a greater power than we control with our thoughts and our desires and our minds. I mean, that baby is not even yours, the way Swami put it so perfectly. He said, parents create the physical vehicle for the soul to express its destiny. But the parents do not create either the soul or the destiny. And so that child uses your body, there's no other word for it, uses a woman's body to make a body for himself, uses the father's sperm to make the body for himself. But it's his body, it's her body coming through, and it's her destiny that's expressing. And no amount of wishing on our part is going to make that any different. We can have as many tantrums as we want, we can insist as we want, we can make 5-year plans, it really won't make any difference. That baby has its own destiny and is going to follow that destiny. And we are all of those things. So we want to make ourselves so neat. We have this one idea. I'm going to have a portable paradise inside in 5 years. As if I was actually master of myself. I mean, really, what the path requires, and the reason so many people have difficulty with it, first of all, it's absolutely humiliating. It's just, well, humbling is a nicer word for it, but humiliating is really what it feels like. Because when we finally step into this kshatriya level and really try to do battle with ourselves, we realize, you know, we do not have that control. And we have control over the way Swami describes it is we have many mental citizens. We have a whole metropolitan area of mental citizens. And, you know, just think of how many things go on in even a small city. And that's what we're running. That's what we're doing inside ourselves. Some of us are still binge-watching over here, you know, while other parts of us are trying so hard to do Kriya. And it's all happening simultaneously. So we rub on the mirror where we can. We puff where the energy's flowing and the rest of it. You just have to wait for the baby in the womb to finish its job. So that is the reality. And it's not a curse. It's not a failure. If we're smart, it's not even a surprise. People will come to me sometimes for counseling and they'll start out by saying, well, I know it's stupid to feel this way. You know, I know I have this idea. I know it's stupid. I know I really shouldn't feel this way. It's just stupid. That's the word people tend to like, stupid, like that. I'll say, actually, it's not stupid at all. You know, you're a brilliant, marvelous, strong aspect of God. Even if you're crummy at it, you know, you're trying, you're doing this. And you have spent millions of lifetimes developing these attitudes. And as you developed them, they were not a mistake. It's like saying to a kindergartner, Swami says one thing about education. He says, You should never ask children to do things in school that they will later be embarrassed about. He said, on a child level, you should always be offering them noble truths. You know, I mean, you can dress your little child up like a pumpkin and make them have pumpkin noises and so on like that and sing really dumb songs. And then they're just, it's cute, but it's embarrassing. But, and so that when they're older, they've learned nothing, they just feel silly about it. He said, you should honor the divine in them, and everything they do, even on a child level, should still have the dignity of their soul, and it should express a truth that they can understand. Swami talked about, he put it this way, he said when he was a child, they sang a song, climb, climb, sunshine mountain, faces all aglow. That's how he said, they had to sing this little song when he was 6. He said, a child does not think of his face as being all aglow. He thinks of it as covered with sweat from climbing Sunshine Mountain, he said. It's like you can't just impose these sort of pretty ideas because children are just like the rest of us. And so when we decided it was a good idea to be selfish in this way, to fight for this, to hunker down and hide from challenges, in the context it made sense to us. If it didn't, we wouldn't have done it. And in doing that, we built really deep grooves in our consciousness. But now we're not in kindergarten anymore. But that doesn't mean what we did when we were six was inappropriate when we were six. It wasn't stupid when we were six. It was exactly the right thing to do. One of my friends told me when she was having her second child and her first child was about three and she was really worried about sibling rivalry. Her little boy says to her one day, "When the baby comes, I'm going to eat him." Mother thinks, oh no, even before the baby comes, it's beginning. But she stayed calm and she said, "Why would you want to do that, darling? So he can come out of my tummy too, just like he's coming out of yours." You see, the point of view was entirely different. And so when we were children in our consciousness, the point of view was entirely different and we made the best decisions we could make. And they weren't stupid. But now we need to put them behind. But you see how very respectful that is? All that I was saying about don't set children up to be humiliated later. It's better if they're not. But within ourselves, we look lovingly at our children, don't we? We look lovingly at the little adorable things that they said and did. When I was 10 years old, and this was the truth, this was a big statement of mine. I had taken up with bad companions as far as my parents were concerned. They happened to be the most interesting friends I could find at the age of 10. And my parents thought they were a bad influence on me. And I was a very small but feisty person. I remember planting my feet and saying to announcing to my parents at the age of 10, "The die is cast. I'm either a good kid or a bad kid, and there's nothing you can do about it now." Now, in retrospect, actually, I was telling them the truth, and I knew it. I knew that I was living with them, but they were not defining me, and that myself, I mean, this is partly just who I was, myself was stronger than their influence. But I also was telling them, "I'm going to play with these kids whether you like it or not." But I can imagine my parents must have died laughing after they walked away from me. Can you imagine a kid declaring like that? But for one thing, it was wiser than they might have realized, although I think as life progressed, they saw it. But still, we just are what we are, and we do the best we can, and we should be proud of what we've done. But now when it's time to repudiate it, its tentacles are pretty far into it. And just the mere thought that I don't want to be that way anymore, even the thought that this is agonizing for me to be this way anymore. If it's a little smoke over the flame, but if it's the baby in the womb, we don't want to lose everything. You see? It's bad enough that we have these delusions, but if we make a huge complex about having these delusions and put ourselves not in cooperation to move forward, but in constant conflict with ourselves and lay this huge complex of unworthiness over what is already a very big job, then we become one of the 999, at least for this incarnation. Over 45 years of watching people on the spiritual path, I've seen that the ones who gradually really do develop that portable paradise are not necessarily the most talented, the most extraordinary, the most this or the most that. They're the ones who are most humble and sincere and don't give up. Patience is the fastest route to God. But my advice on the spiritual path has gotten so simple. I can still go into all the complexities of everybody's reality, as I still do with mine. But at the end of it, I have just like two words: don't quit. Really, think about it. We can't anyway, so all we do is delay. But just don't quit. If you fail a bazillion times, it's the baby in the womb, that's all. It's right there in the Gita. Oh, I thought it was the rust on the mirror. Turns out it's the baby in the womb. You know, it's the baby in the womb. But the baby eventually comes out. That's what the Gita promises. That's what God promises. That's all we have to remember. Don't quit. Just don't quit. Persevere. I was told that Master said, he said, those who persevere to the end, he said, I or one of the other gurus will be there to greet them when this incarnation is over. And I'm told that he said, you don't have to march triumphantly across the finish line. He says, you don't even have to crawl across the finish line. You can slither across on your belly. And I don't know if he really said that or not, but I like to think he did. Just don't quit. That's all that matters. God bless you.